Darren Linden, welcome to the X-Agility Podcast. How are you doing today?
Yeah, very good. Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Darren. I met you for the first time, I think it was 2015 or 2016, when we were working at a large bank, actually a credit card company. It was a pleasure to meet you then. And I was very impressed with you as a change agent. You would have been a senior leader, but I would have penciled you down as maybe a kind of director, where director is a really important thing in that company, but actually actively part of the change. But what I've noticed is that you've moved into executive leadership in the last few years. And I'd love you to explain to the audience, Darren, how that transition went for you from being an active change agent who really knew his stuff on agility and all that kind of stuff to a situation where you're now CEO of a company and helping CEOs of other companies.
Yeah, I've been involved in change and delivery for over 20 years. I ran a dot-com during the dot-com boom in the late 90s, a web development company. And I guess throughout my career, I've always cultivated those entrepreneurial urges, really. After having the experience of running a business, it's always been my ambition to get back into that, really. And it was always about trying to find the right time and the right opportunity. So if you look at those two opportunities, where I am now and where I was in the 90s as bookends in between, was a career really spent at the coalface, leading large-scale transformation and change for some of the biggest brands in the UK, if not the world. I was at AOL, involved in launching broadband, went into mobile with T-Mobile, led their digital transformation, led a large £100 million digital transformation at O2. I was transformation director at Sky, leading their transformation. Then obviously our paths met when I was at the bank. And I guess where I am right now, the reason I'm CEO of this business is this business needed a practitioner. So rather than a seasoned executive, a generalist, we value specialism, we value expertise. And I had a couple of opportunities to come here and to turn them down for various reasons because the timing wasn't right. But I really bought into where this business really wants to go and what it wants to do. And we all believe that my practitioner background could maybe make the difference in helping us get there.
Really cool. And so I'm curious what compromises you might have noticed along the way, because when you're a change agent and you're helping people to do better product management or release a product or do a transformation, or the change being the work, we're going to talk about that later on, then you're in a CEO position and you have to run the organization, but also sometimes you feel like you need to change the organization or be the guardian of the culture so that the company can change. Have you noticed any situations where you thought there's a bit of tension here? I'm feeling that what I would have been saying before as a non-exec has now been tested.
Yeah, it's recognizing, first of all, that you're not the only expert in the room. If I think back to my delivery career, often I was in very senior roles, but setting the pattern, setting the direction, being very clear on the direction that we were going to take. In this business, it's very much about the power of the team. So I can set the vision and have a very clear strategy for where we want to be and what we want to try and achieve. But how we go and do that isn't necessarily down to me. It's down to the people around me. And of course, naturally, that creates tension because we'll have varying views on the various sort of shapes and forms that we take in order to make those things happen. So it's letting go, really, of some of my opinions and some of the things that I've held true, and to be open to listening to what others believe could make a difference. So very much being that sort of servant leader, very much enabling people to be a success and giving them all the tools that they need and removing the barriers and the obstacles, while not necessarily actually telling them how to do it. And it's a very different dynamic when you're leading a large-scale transformation or you're leading large-scale change, when you have an executive team that are very much looking to you to come up with the blueprint and then fill in the details. So that's probably been the hardest thing, actually. Strong opinions loosely held, making sure that I'm really empowering the team that we've built around us.
So I'm trying to imagine a situation, Darren, where let's say you're with your exec team, you're with your reports, and let's imagine a situation where your reports aren't quite at the races in terms of where you want them to be thinking. You have the answer in your head. You understand as a change agent that you need to speak last, not speak first. You need to listen and so on. And so how would you deal with the situation where the answers just aren't coming up in the room? It's almost like people are, they're like hamsters on a wheel, just stuck in a pattern and kind of can't get out of it. Have you ever come across situations like that, Darren?
Yeah, every day, John. We're moving at such a pace here. We are a hyper-growth business, so we're scaling up rapidly. And what we're trying to do is fuel momentum. So we're trying to avoid inertia. So naturally, you'll get those sort of frustrations where you can see the answer and you're trying to tease it out of people. But the way I tend to work is very much at a principles level. So rather than trying to be very specific and very detailed and go right down to the nth degree where you're effectively prescribing the work and prescribing the answer, you can very much operate at a principles level and start to sow those seeds. And then you start to nudge things in the direction that you believe it needs to go. But the substance and the detail that sits underneath that still emerges from the team. It's really just giving them clarity on directionally what we think will make the difference rather than actually filling in all the blanks and all of the detail.
So it requires a lot of patience then, because that could take quite a while. That could take months in some cases, I'm guessing.
Yeah, diplomacy is key. I think you've got to be really clear on the type of leader that you want to be, first of all. So I think integrity is so important to me. So I've, over the last sort of 20 years, I've very much cultivated the type of leader I want to be. And a lot of that is born out of a lot of the experiences that I had at the coalface, a lot of the leaders that I work for, some of the people that I had really great experiences with. It's almost like a patchwork quilt of leadership traits I now hold dear. But also the leaders that I work for that didn't get the best out of me and making sure that I don't replicate those behaviors and those traits, because I could see the impact, the negative impact that had on me. So you have to really protect the integrity of that leadership style if you genuinely believe that's the thing that's going to make the difference. And diplomacy and patience is absolutely key. Doesn't mean that you can't be autocratic where you need to. If you urgently need to make a breakthrough, then occasionally you do have to call it and say, this is it. We're going to make a breakthrough and this is how it needs to be. But it's just making sure that you're not too prescriptive. I think that's the most important thing. People need direction. People need boundaries and guardrails. But you don't have to fill in all the blanks. You don't have to fill in all the details. For me, I've noticed expertise exists in the most unexpected places. Mm. So it's how do you create a framework? How do you create an environment where that expertise can flourish, no matter how experienced people might be, how junior people might be? I think it's giving them an environment where they feel confident enough that there's enough substance there, but enough space and enough room for them to really emerge and allow their ideas to flourish.
Thanks, Darren. You reminded me of an expression that I learned when I was in the same bank as you back those years ago. One of my colleagues, he said to me, we need to be careful about not inflicting help on people. I thought it was a nice expression, inflicting help.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of a little story with Tom Mellor. I think I was driving around Illinois with Tom Mellor. And he said to me in the car, I really remember this, I quote this a lot, where he said to me, John, don't ever give help unless people ask for it. But I think he was giving me help when he told me that. So it's tricky, isn't it? So it's a loaded question, because basically what I'm asking is, what kind of help do you think executives need in these times? Because on the assumption that they're looking for help, some people are saying, I don't want any help, thank you very much, I'm doing absolutely fine. But if people were receptive to these challenging help in these challenging times, would you have any kind of key tips for people, Darren?
Yeah, look, we're not infallible. I'm not infallible. Objectivity is really key. And I think sometimes as a senior leader, where you are put into positions where you're having to give people answers, you're having to try to make breakthroughs when you've got a bit of stasis, sometimes you can believe your own hype and you can believe that you can do no wrong. So what I've done here, we've built an advisory board pretty quickly. So some real captains of industry that we've got around the table who can really hold us to account. And I guess see the wood for the trees, but we're immersed in this business day to day. And we're trying to carve out something really unique in the consulting industry. The only thing that really matters is what's going to add value for our clients, not what we think is going to add value for our clients. So surrounding ourselves with really experienced people who have diversity of thought. So what we haven't done is hire people that think the same and have the same sort of background and the same sort of careers. They come from very different backgrounds and they genuinely disagree. So that creates that tension that really ensures that the decisions that we do make really are the ones that are going to get cut through. And they really are the ones that are going to add value. And I think you have to be humble, right, in order to be able to do that, accepting that, you know, you might carry the CEO title, but often you're not the most important person in the room. It's those that work for you and those that you hire to hold you to account and give you that objectivity that sometimes you can't see yourself. So, yeah, that humility to be able to accept those opinions and accept that you may well have got it wrong, I think it's just fundamentally important.
Yeah, you just reminded me, Darren, that sometimes in more complicated, large organizations, the CEO doesn't actually have any power.
Yeah.
It's because the power is actually in the matrix. It's the minus ones might actually have more power through the matrix than the regional president that might be in a region or even the CEO of a company. I've noticed that. I was told a story by someone only last week about a big piece of work he was trying to get, and the CEO couldn't get a purchase order through for one whole year.
Yeah.
So it can be really tricky. That kind of brings me back to how we figure out whether we're on the right track. And there's a couple of measurement models out there, Darren. One of them is called evidence-based management from scrum.org. And I'll just explain it to you and the audience to explain the kind of dilemma that we might hear, because essentially while a lot of us talk about focus being a really important thing, there is a danger that if we're over focused without thinking about balance, that we could miss a trick. And one of the things I like about Scrum.org's model, they've got this evidence-based management thing where the top right corner there would be, if anyone reading this offline, that you've got the current value, which is how well are we milking the cow that we already have kind of thing. If you overdo that, you end up like Nokia, Blockbuster, the usual suspects, BlackBerry, and so on. If you overdo time to market, you could have a situation where maybe we've cut quality. Maybe the countermeasure is, okay, we've increased time, but we've got more technical debt. We've got more failure demand with our customers. We've got poor customer service. Or maybe we've misunderstood time to market as meaning time to delivery and not time to learn. It's good to focus on speed, but if you just over-focus on speed, you end up with what we call a feature factory. You're delivering stuff, but you've no idea if it's making a difference or not. We're just delivering loads of stuff. And if we're doing well or we're not doing well, it's coincidental because actually there's no real science to how we're operating. It's just throwing stuff at the wall, literally. And then you have ability to innovate, which is more like inability to innovate, which I see as what's slowing us down. Maybe we've got some systems that are too bureaucratic. People don't have the right tooling. They've got too much multitasking. There's too many projects going on at the same time in the org, things like that. If you over-focus on ability to innovate, you might have the cleanest product in the world with the best design, but maybe nobody's using it. And so there's problems with over-indexing on any of these. And the last one from evidence-based management would be unrealized value, which is essentially trying to find the next billion-dollar idea. Find your next curve, as Guy Kawasaki used to say. If we're milking the cow right now, which is the metaphor for a current product or service, what's the next metaphorical goat or sheep or vegan product? You know, I get the idea. And if you over-focus on that, if you could lose your shirt on experiments and not just find any new product, and you've lost all of your current customers. This kind of articulates for me one of the dilemmas that you might have as an executive, because you need to run the org, you need to change the org. But also, it's not just that. Even within your product set, your service set, you've got some products or services that could get disrupted and you need to find the next one and you need to be on your toes, on the front foot, as they say, to kind of react to that. I'm curious, Darren, if this is something that you've noticed yourself as an executive, this need for balance in terms of where you place your bets as a company.
Yeah, 100%. In fact, I'd take it up a level because I think a model like this sometimes becomes a little bit too binary, right? Actually, yeah. You take it up a level and you think about the sentiment is we're trying to build adaptability into our DNA. Yeah. So our ability to be able to adapt and pivot depending on the market dynamics. We're in a hugely volatile business environment, not just in consulting, but just in general. So the ability to be able to build adaptability into our DNA is absolutely key. And often what we're trying to do is we're trying to ensure that there's strategy and execution work in harmony. So what I've found throughout my career, and I see it a lot within our clients as well, is there's huge amounts of investment in building agility and adaptability into the delivery machine. But at the strategic level, it's still very linear. So you build a delivery machine that is very much set up to take small batches of work through and make sure you get flow and time to value dramatically increases. But often it fundamentally fails because what you're trying to actually push into that machine are these big linear strategic initiatives that they don't break up. So we talk a lot about just trying to find those opportunities that are hiding in plain sight. If you think about, it's a bit like military tactics, right? You land in a country and you need to fight a battle that's probably 5,000 miles away. The way that you get there is to create permission by fighting street by street, village by village, town by town. And the tactics that you deploy, by the time you get to that city 5,000 miles away, they've emerged. They've emerged based on the battles that you fought street by street, village by village, town by town. And business strategy is probably no different. If you're thinking anything beyond 90 days or anything beyond 3 months, it's hope at best. So look for those adjacent opportunities. Look for those growth opportunities that are really hiding in plain sight and go after those. And you start to adapt your organization based on what you learn. So it's very much then shifting away from subjectivity to objectivity. So looking at the data, the insight, the analytics, the research, as much information as you can get your hands on about that short-term opportunity to start to inform decisions that you're going to make in the future. And I think it means you have to be comfortable with uncertainty. You have to be comfortable with unpredictability. And I think that's a key trait in any executive now. And you'd be amazed at how many executives are still have got that thirst for certainty, that thirst for predictability, which then drags them back to the world that they've been in before that has started to see their businesses fail. The big linear strategy and trying to shoehorn that into an agile delivery machine that they spent many months, many years and millions of pounds trying to cultivate. So I think that focus on adaptability, John, is absolutely key for me. And I think it encompasses the four things that you just described, but probably a lot more than that as well.
Yeah, you just reminded me of something, actually. The journey that executives need to go on, for me, is going from managing expectations about dates to managing expectations about uncertainty.
Right, yeah.
And sometimes they use tools like probabilistic forecasts and things like that, where it's using some really cool tools, or even free spreadsheets from Troy McGinnis, for example, where you just say, okay, 85% chance we deliver by that date. That means 15% chance we won't. But you know what? Things might change. So I'll give you a better forecast next week. And just by saying that expression at the end means that this forecast is wrong. And then I will come back next week and it will be a slightly different day. And the following week, it'll be a slightly different day. And then we say, hey, in a second, you keep giving me a different day. I said, yeah, welcome to uncertainty. It's like the weather. It's not much different to the weather. You know, Magda thinks it's going to rain at 4 o'clock today. Is it going to rain? Like, she doesn't realize it's based on probabilities. And she knows actually it's based on probabilities, because if it doesn't rain, she knows that it's wrong some of the time. And it's like that for our work as well, isn't it, Darren?
100%. The environment that we're all in is so unpredictable. If you think about the democratization of technology and how the barriers to entry in any market have been so significantly reduced, how can you predict what consumers are going to want, let alone what competition is going to emerge? So trying to do that and going through the traditional yearly planning cycles, the 3 to 5 year strategy, it just doesn't work in this sort of environment. So taking a step back and looking at the culture and the DNA that needs to be in your business in order to be able to not just survive, but thrive in those dynamics is key. And it does take mindset shifts from executives to be comfortable with the uncertainty and the volatility and the unpredictability that comes with that. And I think you embrace it. We talk a lot to our clients about, we believe there are competitive responses to disruption. So they're positive responses. Your response to disruption doesn't have to be a negative reaction. So many businesses, particularly during things like the pandemic, decided that their reaction was going to be hibernation. So this is too volatile, it's too unpredictable. So what we're going to do is we're going to hunker down and we're going to hibernate and we're just going to try and maintain the status quo. There's always people around you that are going to innovate. They're going to use it as an opportunity to grow. And if you think you're standing still, you're not, because the baseline around you is shifting. So actually you're going backwards. So standing still and hibernating and trying to maintain the status quo isn't an option if you really want to thrive and you really want to push on in this environment. So embracing things like adaptability, embracing uncertainty, embracing unpredictability and actually using it as a bit of a superpower, I think it's a key trait that we now need to see in executive leaders across all industries.
Yeah, we often hear this expression, oh, you're moving the goalposts, but sometimes the goalposts do need to move because we're building up some evidence based on analytics, as you said, or maybe even just talking to customers. And we've learned actually that maybe we shouldn't go to Mars. Maybe we should look under the Pacific Ocean and build some life there, just using that as a metaphor. But the point is that what I don't mean is for every single data point that come in, you change direction. That would be like whack-a-mole, just whacking the mole in the fun fair. But if you notice every couple of months, the data is telling you that actually the goal that you're aiming for is the wrong goal, you should change it.
Exactly, yeah. Right. John, we're not talking about huge seismic changes here either. We're talking about shifting more away from the sort of big monolithic projects and programs to a world of optimization and iteration. I've certainly found in my career, often there are assumptions, things don't work, therefore we need to rebuild. We need to go greenfield and spend huge amounts of money. But often optimization of existing products and services unlocks more value. Those opportunities are often hiding in plain sight. And often, again, businesses sort of defer change to technology. This product's not working, therefore our technology must be broken. So we're going to go and outsource it to tech and they're going to go and fix it. And often that's just deferring the problem to somebody else rather than actually dealing with the real problem. And it's often just in the front end, tweaks to customer journeys, tweaks to experiences, tweaks to languages, that actually, the language that you use, that actually really makes the difference rather than wholesale rebuild. So I actually think you can unlock real value that you probably didn't realize you could unlock if you take a much more iterative view and look at optimization rather than huge investments in big projects and programs. But making sure that every change that you decide to make is based on objectivity rather than subjectivity. It's not, we call it the fetishization of subject matter expertise. You have these people that have been in organizations for so long, and therefore they design products and services in their image rather than in the image of the people that really matter. So listen to customers, really understand what they value, what they believe is going to make the difference. And often you find it's just those marginal gains. It's those small tweaks that can be delivered in a very short period of time. Some of those come together to unlock far more value than if you were spending £50 million on a 3-year transformation.
Totally agree, Darren. Darren, you and I, we both were at different points of our careers, transformation director, some kind of top change agent in an organization, and we've been part of a transformation team, if you like. I'm guilty as charged. And I'd like to hear your perspective on looking back now. You can see what works and what doesn't work. And are we ever finished? Is when I hear people said, I did this transformation, that transformation, it's never finished. But I'm curious what your perspective is now, Darren, on what's the best way for change really to be adopted in an organization. Would you start a transformation team, actually, or what approach would you take these days?
I think change has to be a constant. So it's no longer a temporary vehicle that you stand up with a team, with a fixed budget, and then expect at some point in the future, there's going to be this great big reveal to this transformed state, to this changed state, and then everything's going to be fine and everything's going to be great from that point onwards. The dynamics don't work like that anymore. So the work is the change, and the change is the work, and it needs to be embedded into BAU. So really managing that tension between executives that have 3 months to hit targets and organizations that believe they need to fundamentally change products, services, technology. So I coined this phrase transforming through the line, and I don't really like the word transformation anymore because it still has, in my view, negative connotations. But all transforming through the line really means is trying to connect large change to business as usual and ensuring that you're looking at strategies and ways of unlocking really big complex change problems and delivering value very quickly. So it's pulled by the business teams. So for example, a sales director that needs to hit a quarterly target, how can we take something that might normally take 3 to 5 years to deliver and break it apart in a way that we can unlock value very quickly, and it helps them to be successful in the short term, as well as creating a strategic legacy for the long term? Because the reality is most executives now and in most disrupted industries are in their roles for 2 to 3 years. They're not going to bet on something that's jammed tomorrow where an outcome is going to be delivered in 3 years' time. By that point, they've moved on. So you have to find a way to break these things apart and ensure that value is unlocked. So you've got the business as usual teams really pulling, the operational teams really pulling the work that you're doing, because they need it in order for them to be a success right now. But you can still design that in a way that comes together to leave a transformed state and a strategic legacy. And I think a lot of organizations miss the point of that. I still think they believe that it still has to be the way that it's always done because they believe it's predictable. They believe it's safer. They believe that you're de-risking change. But actually what you're doing is potentially investing in things that are no longer going to be relevant, because by the time these end states have been achieved, the whole world has moved on by then.
Yeah, totally. Just about agility in general, I was talking to a lady called Priya Maria Thorian from Agile People. She was in the first episode of Exergy podcast, and she said something that I quote to this day. She had a metaphor of a flower in front of her. She said, "Grow, flower, grow." I'm telling the flower to grow, like, and it's kind of a nonsense telling a flower to grow, isn't it? And her point was, we need to create the environment in which the flower can actually grow. And Klaus Leopold said something similar. He said, agility is not a team sport, it's a company sport. And so the role of executives in actually fixing problems beyond the control or influence of the teams and in actually decluttering workflows, processes, and systems is really important. I've seen one of my clients, for example, where they're rolling out an agility framework at the moment for a team level, and everyone's bowing at the altar of leadership, showing which teams are more agile than others, and actually they're missing a few tricks. And I'd love to kind of get your advice for the execs out there in terms of what would be one of the first things that you look at if you did want to try and create an environment where agility can really grow so that the company can really prosper. Any kind of starting points, Darren, that you'd like people to look at?
Yeah, I think it's recognizing in any business, there's probably two groups of people. There's artists and soldiers. There's a really great book, actually. That phrase came from a book called Loon Shots by a guy called Safi Bacall. And what it does is it looks at those sort of great big ideas from science and medicine, and I guess the techniques that could be applied in business and products, etc. And if you think about it, we have artists in businesses, right? These are people that are very creative. They tend to innovate. And what they need is freedom. They need the freedom to express their talents and their ideas and their concepts. So they need to work outside the system. But so many organizations hire for innovation, they hire artists, but then they force them to work inside the system that's fundamentally broken. And then they wonder why innovation doesn't really flourish within their businesses. So that'd be the first thing, right? Recognize that these people are artists, and the environment that they need in order to do great work is very different than your soldiers. And if you think about what gets the best out of soldiers, its predictability, its regime, its structure. But every organization needs soldiers too. You need soldiers to run some of your more predictable processes and business as usual and your operations. And the art here is, how do you get your artists and your soldiers to really work in harmony? So when you create really great ideas and great innovation, those things need to scale. You might have a game-changing product, but if you're looking for your artists to be able to scale that and industrialize that and push that into market to be a success, that's not going to work on its own. Now you need to work in tandem with your soldiers, who will take those concepts and those ideas and turn them into something that works in a much more structured and a much more predictable way. There are lots of nuances in businesses, right? So the processes and the tools and the patterns that you need in order to make your artists and your soldiers really work in harmony will depend on the nuances of your firm. But I think, first of all, it's critical to recognize that you do need both of those groups of people, and the way that they work and the environments they need are going to be subtly different.
Darren, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Exergy podcast. Thank you very much for giving us your stories as an executive and your journey from change agent to executive.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for the time, Joel. Thanks for having me.